Now, as today we come from France to England, the contrast stands out. And that is the reason why I have left England, in a way, to the last. For while in France in the 17th century, the absolute state was proving a model for all of Europe to follow, England at the same time cut off the head of her anointed monarch and substituted one monarch for another. It is small wonder that throughout the 17th century, the English enjoyed a reputation for unruliness unmatched in the rest of Europe. Do you mean how did they come into the localities? How did the local squire adopt Puritanism? Well, that is almost impossible to answer. It is probably part of a real Protestant tradition that had built up in certain areas of England. There is the explanation that as the center of Puritanism was Norfolk, and Norfolk was the part of England nearest to Holland and the continent, that it is there that Protestant missionaries, which also existed, came in closest. It has also to do with those places where the Puritans succeeded in either capturing the ministries or opening a kind of unlicensed preaching, which they did in a great many places. They were persecuted, but in a great many places they did that. And, of course, the merchant classes eventually were easily Protestantized, also in London, above all and around, through Puritan preaching, and afterwards, of course, through the fact that the House of Commons adopted a certain economic policy. But the economic policy comes after the preaching. Yes. No. No. Yes, good heavens. I mean, try to explain it to you this way. Who are the common people? Let's make it quite clear. They were not totally out of it, because we are going to come to them once we have started the revolution. They are totally out of it now. No doubt, as you will see, they made certain pressures. But who are the common people? You have this utterly idiotic idea. I don't know where. The only reason I think is you still think of the French Revolution as a model. You start a revolution by storming the Bastille. The Bastille was organized, very well organized. So don't think of it in these terms. The common people come into our revolutionary story when they become organized by the local Puritan groups. And they become organized, I don't want to go ahead too far, in the army. And therefore, you will see that where the common people come into this, and I'll talk about that next time because it's very central, is in the revolutionary army. They come in and they act, as you will see in the first public debate we have in modern history, where the common people come in. They come in as the field soldiers of the regiments. That is where they will come in, and where they will play an enormous role, as we shall see next time in the so-called army debate. Strongest of the Tudor monarchs is also directly responsible in many ways for the survival of the English Parliament. Now, why? There are two reasons for this. First of all, unlike the European estates, the English Parliament had gotten the power of extraordinary taxation into their hands. And when there was inflation, when the king could no longer live of his own, when he was always nearly bankrupt, as you know, because of the inflation, then the power to levy extraordinary taxes was an important power. And that the English Parliament got during the Middle Ages. But still it wasn't enough, because medieval estates had that same power. And what the kings did, they just continued the power and didn't ask Parliament anymore. That's what happened in Spain. That's what happened everywhere else. so that even this first reason isn't really reason enough. The second reason is the real one, the Reformation. For the English Reformation, I remind you briefly, was an act of politics. Henry, remember, was religiously orthodox, but he was in a difficult position where the Pope was endangering the whole future of the Tudor dynasty. Remember how important regular succession was. Remember how important that was to strengthening a monarchy. Remember what happened when there was weak monarchies or minorities, like at the outbreak of the French religious wars. So that when Catherine of Aragon was unable to have anything but a girl, and Henry wanted to marry Anne Boleyn, this was a most serious matter for the future of the dynasty. Let me remind you that Anne Boleyn was pregnant. It couldn't be known that she also would have a girl, the future Queen Elizabeth, but Henry hoped that it would be a boy to carry on the dynasty. Therefore, Henry did a rather shrewd political act. He began to blackmail the Pope to grant his divorce, because this was, for him, almost in a way, a matter of life and death for the future of the Tudors. But in that blackmail, he took Parliament into partnership, for this was very convenient. He could control Parliament. But if the Pope gave in, he could always say, well, it wasn't really my idea, it was the idea of Parliament which pushed me to abrogate the power in Rome, in England. He always had an out. But the result was that Parliament sat for 7 years straight, that it got procedure, it got a journal, it emerged from that experience as a set institution. Not only that, but still more serious for the future, Parliament had legislated on religion at the King's request in order for his blackmail policy to succeed. It had legislated on religion, and it could now claim to do this with impunity. Once Henry was succeeded by weak monarchs, Parliament could assert its right to legislate in this manner, and it did so, for Henry was succeeded by weak monarchs. In the reign of Queen Mary the Catholic, for example, Catherine of Aragon's daughter, Parliament refused to legislate against the Protestants who had fled overseas. Parliament refused to restore the property to the church, the property which had been expropriated during the time of Henry VIII. Therefore, as a result of the Reformation, Henry bequeathed a Parliament strengthened and filled with new ambitions. But that wasn't the only legacy of Henry VIII. Henry VIII bequeathed this kind of Parliament, but he also bequeathed a state church. Now, you might very well say, what's so extraordinary about that? There were state churches in every part of Europe. The Peace of Augsburg made them general in Germany. Eventually, the Peace of Westphalia all over. But there was something extraordinary about Henry's legacy, for it was a state church which was not theologically settled. It was neither Lutheran, nor Calvinist, nor Zwinglian. It had really no properly worked out a theological base. It had, if you like, a waiting posture, waiting what would happen, waiting what faction would win. Henry, of course, was not a Lutheran. He burnt Lutherans. He was not a Calvinist. He tried to be a Catholic Orthodox, but still he abolished all the institutions that went with Catholic Orthodoxy. A very unsettled situation. And thus, from the beginning, the question arose, how Protestant would the English state church be? Didn't arise in any of the other state churches. There the king was Lutheran or Calvinist or Zwinglian. But here it arose. It was unsettled. how Protestant should the unsettled state church be. Now in 1560, his granddaughter Elizabeth inherited these problems, for they had not been settled between Henry's death and her accession. Indeed, they had been aggravated. She inherited a strong parliament and an unsettled religious question, but both things really aggravated. Why? First of all, because the religious question by 1560 had become bound up with foreign policy. This had happened in the reign of Queen Mary Tudor, Queen Mary the Catholic. For Queen Mary had not only led England back to Catholicism, but remember, through her marriage to Philip II of Spain, she had led England into the Habsburg fold. She had led England to become, in effect, a satellite of the Habsburgs through her marriage with King Philip II of Spain. This was highly unpopular, and from then on in, until way into the 19th century, Catholicism and Spain became bound up in the English mind. Now, Elizabeth immediately faced that problem. It was, in fact, the first she faced. What could she do? How could she disentangle England from Spain? How could she declare her political independence again after the reign of her daughter? She avoided a showdown until 1588, until the famous battle with the Armada. But in all these 22 years, she managed by masterstrokes of diplomacy to hold Spain off. She supported, you remember, the Dutch against Spain. That was one way of doing it, of delaying a showdown. She played around with giving a hand in marriage, first to Philip and then to other candidates of Spain. That was another way of staving off the showdown. But it also meant something else. She had to go slow on making England Protestant. For a Protestant England, an immediate Protestant England, would have meant a showdown with Spain. For remember that especially Philip II, a figure out of the Catholic Reformation, Philip II believed that Spain and Catholicism were one, and that any Protestantism such as that of the Netherlands was a direct threat to the predominance of Spain. Thus, a Protestant England would have been a direct threat to Spain, would have been a declaration of independence, which Elizabeth hoped to avoid. But in avoiding this, in this rather brilliant diplomacy, which postponed a showdown for 22 years, a second element enters in. The dissatisfaction of those who wanted a real Protestant church. The dissatisfaction of those who wanted Elizabeth to go into a Protestant direction. Now, why and how did that come about? For by Henry VIII's death, there were very few Protestants in England. By Henry VIII's death, Protestantism was not in England yet any kind of major factor. Once again, Mary Tudor, Mary the Catholic, laid the groundwork for the problem her sister had to face. If before her reign, Protestantism was not a great issue in English life, if it was a matter for intellectual circles and intellectual coteries, two actions of Mary the Catholic made it an issue in English life. First of all, her policy of persecution, not only of the great, because everyone was used to that, but of the common folk, which made for sympathy. She actually burnt only very few people at the stake, some 150. But of those, a great many were common people. And what is worse, they found a hagiographer. They found a man who enshrined them in a book which after the Bible was to be the most popular book in all of England. Fox's famous Book of Martyrs. Fox's Book of Martyrs enshrined these people who had died for their faith, and enshrined above all the humble people who had been burnt on Smithfield, in Smithfield. And from now on, Fox's Book of Martyrs is one of the great engines for Protestantism in England. But secondly, still more important, because the humble people were burnt, but the humble people don't make revolutions. Though, secondly, well, hell's bells, they really don't. Don't be such idiots. Don't be such idiots. This is a historical fact. Don't always come to me and say, the humble people, you are thinking of the storming of the Bastille. That is still your revolution. I would have thought Lenin put an end to that kind of ideal of a revolution. That, and the storming of the Bastille was well organized, very well organized. Don't be ridiculous. Now, secondly, those Protestants who had fled went to the European centers of Protestantism, such as Geneva. And these exiles saw the goodly society in action. They went to the Protestant parts in Geneva, in Europe. Typically enough, the Lutherans wouldn't let them in. That is the reason that Lutheranism plays no role in the future in England. The Lutheran princes, conservative and hesitant, wouldn't welcome these refugees from Mary. But the Calvinist and Zwinglian regents did. That is the point. Now, these people we must look at closer. For it is these people who were given the name, eventually, Puritan, because they wanted to purify the church from those things which to them smacked of Catholicism, which were not in tune with European Protestant practice. It is they who started the rows in Elizabeth's reign by attacking the wearing of vestments, by attacking bishops, and all of that sort of thing. But it will help you if you remember this about the Puritans, that they were not a sect, not a movement as the Lutherans or the Calvinists or the Anabaptists were. They were simply a loose group of people who wanted a more Protestant church and who wanted it at once. That is true. Some were Calvinists, some Zwinglians, some in between. But their theology varied widely. But what they had in common is they wanted Protestantism, and they wanted it right now. Puritanism was not a distinct theology. Puritanism is instead an attitude towards life. It was also, you will be happy to note, the beginning of a new kind of radical politics. Now, why? In exile, these Protestants had come in contact with Calvinism, to be sure, and they brought back many Calvinist attitudes, but not necessarily Calvinist theology. What do I mean by that? What do I mean by that? Calvinist attitude, not Calvinist theology, by and large. They were a body of men who had replaced personal loyalty to king by ideological commitment. Now, why? Because these people were outs and completely outs in a hopeless situation. Those who had exiled themselves from the England of Queen Mary, from Mary in England, had nowhere at home to look to. Parliament restored Catholicism. It didn't, to be sure, want to give back property, but it restored Catholicism. There was no big nobility to which they could look. They were, by and large, Catholic. The Queen restored Catholicism. They were completely cut off from the homeland, and therefore they could not go to Calvin's aristocratic ideas of resistance. There was no Huguenot nobility to lead them, not in Scotland, not in England, nowhere, in fact, where these refugees looked. Thus they were thrown upon themselves, political radicals, who for the first time advocated tyrannicide, or, if more moderate, the immediate deposition of the monarch. The Huguenots, as you know, had been an aristocratic opposition. In the Netherlands, it was the patriciate of the cities who finally took over. But in England, that seemed impossible. Therefore, these exiles were intellectuals, not aristocrats. They believed that the sword, as John Knox put it, must be put into the people's hands, by which, of course, they meant their own. They formed themselves into a revolutionary elite, which was new, because it was not aristocratic, not based on inherited privilege or power, no Montmorencys or Colignys or William of Orange. They based it upon the consciousness of election, but a consciousness of election which was not tied to inheritance, to tradition, to history, to anything out of, to use a modern phrase, their own radical consciousness. Their own radical consciousness, made radical by their complete and utter exile and cutting off from any group within England at all. They believed that they had the divine election to carry through a reformation, to fulfill God's purpose. These angry exiles believed that they had a vocation. As in Calvinism, every man had a vocation. But their vocation was the change of religion, and with it, but subordinate, the change of society. They were to make what has been called rightly the revolution of the saints, for they believed themselves to be, in fact, saints in the Calvinist, earthly, pragmatic definition of the elite, of the elect. The saints might differ on church organization, and they did, on points of theology, and they did, but they were united on several matters. First of all, they were united on a moral activism, what I would call an attitude of life. A moral imperative to bring about God's order in the world. The Puritan ideal of continuous action. Organized, methodical. To break down the evil of the world. The evil, of course, of the Queen. The evil of the system which was keeping truth from triumph. Second, they were united on discipline. They did not believe, most of them, in Calvinist discipline. Presbyterians were a small minority, but they all believed in disciplined action, an inner certainty which produced this discipline. Again, Calvinism as an attitude of life. They weren't Presbyterians. But they believed in an inner discipline which would produce outward action. They stressed above all scripture and plain teaching. Preaching. Preaching was their instrument to reform England. And Elizabeth constantly had to forbid non-licensed preaching. For the Puritans went in for preaching. Plain, simple preaching. According to the Calvinist logic, there's a great deal of rationalism in Puritanism, a great deal of use of logic in constructing their sermons. It was plain and simple preaching, contrasting with the learning of the Anglican Church. Such were the saints. I would say that they are probably, in the long view, the first and only successful intellectual elite to produce a revolution. There's only been one further revolution which has been produced by an intellectual elite, the revolution in Bavaria in 1918, and it was a complete failure. While this, of course, was a successful revolution. Now, planned and disciplined action did not exclude flexibility. For they believed in Calvin's doctrine of opportunity. God makes opportunities for you. Thus they worked as long as they could within the Elizabethan establishment. They did not start revolution, they worked within the Elizabethan establishment, seeking to exploit every opportunity according to Calvinist ideas, which I told you once again, once before, time ago. They worked then in the establishment, but this flexibility, the rejection by so many of outward for inner discipline in the end, meant, of course, that the triumph of the elite, they would also fall apart. That in the end they would be, as it proved, unable to stem the chaos which accompanies and results from all revolutions. The end, let me remind you, was a dictatorship. Every revolution has ended that way. Not of an elite, but of one of them, Oliver Cromwell. However that might be, at first they did work from within the establishment. For as they returned from exile, as we would say, they managed to capture one institution in the kingdom, and a most important one, the House of Commons. How did they do that? How did they capture the House of Commons? They captured the House of Commons very simply. It used to be that the king or queen controlled the House of Commons through the privy councillors. Her councillors which sat there and which ran the affair quite well, because everybody respected the privy councillors as the voice of the king in the House of Commons. But now the Puritans got into the House of Commons, and they organized themselves, and they began, in fact, to eclipse the privy councillors, and they began to eclipse in their organization the House of Lords, or drag it really along with them in many ways. Now, what did Elizabeth do in all of this? What stands did and could she take? Her position then, let us summarize, was compounded. An unsettled state church, a potential revolutionary elite which had captured the House of Commons, and finally, a fusion of the religious with other grievances. For example, taxation, the grievances of monopolies, to which I shall come, economic grievances, all the grievances eventually fused. For the Puritan elite was shrewd enough to make use of all the grievances against the monarchy and to organize them and to lead them in the House of Commons. What did Elizabeth do? Elizabeth, it must be clear, was no dogmatist. She never took a stand. And that was, in a sense, greatly to her advantage. It was to a diplomatic advantage, as you have seen in staving off Spain. But it was also to her advantage in internal policy. For what she did is she compromised. The way she compromised, you have read in the Reformation book too, but I will just repeat it here, by standing firm on some things and giving in on others. There is a pattern to that. She stood firm on the change of religion. She supported her Anglican church. She supported the church courts. She supported the censorship. But whenever a member of the House of Commons introduced changes in the church, she said no and arrested him. And the House of Commons protested. And in the end, she settled it by giving ever greater privileges to the House of Commons, but standing firm in religion. Thus, Parliament was ever further strengthened. Its members obtained freedom from arrest. Its members obtained free speech in the House of Commons. They obtained all sorts of privileges, like freedom from arrest and free speech, while on the other hand, the Queen managed to keep the state church together, and to keep the state church on the foundations on which he tried to set it. The result, however, was again pretty ominous for her successor. Why was the result ominous for her successor? Because again Parliament was strengthened and her popularity was not increased. There is the famous last session of Parliament when the Queen came down, the aged Queen, in 1604, 1603. The aged Queen came down and not a man applauded her presence. But what is more, the result of her policy of not taking stands and compromising, you can see in a document in your source book, which is in effect the first document of the English Revolution. The famous apology of 1904, of 1604. What do we mean by apology? It is the declaration to the new king, to James I, coming down from Scotland. And to him, Parliament made an apology. That is to say, it explained to him what it was all about, James coming down from Scotland. Read it carefully, for it sets the tone for the next decade and the revolution. It is document 44. For Parliament tells James, the prerogatives of princes may easily and do daily grow, the privileges of the subject are for the most part as an everlasting stand. They warn him, don't tamper with our privileges. Freedom of speech, freedom from arrest, the right to taxation. But they go much further at the end, for it ends with a very famous sentence, which shows you how far Parliament had become, if you like, a kind of revolutionary body. For it ends with a famous phrase, the voice of the people in things of their knowledge is said to be as the voice of God. The divine right of Parliament was pitted against the divine right of King. The famous phrase that the voice of the people in things of their knowledge is at the voice of God made a claim which was inherently absolute. A claim in this case against more taxation, against economic policies, but above all, a claim for Protestantism. Above all, a claim for Protestant attitude against the king. The word people is, of course, doesn't have the meaning that you give it. In fact, as I said before, you must never use it because it is for our period, for any period, a meaningless word. Don't say people, say mob if you are going to use it. The word people shows that Parliament thought itself as representative of all of England. The voice of the people in things of their knowledge is like the voice of God. Parliament representative, but was it representative? The answer, of course, is a large no. Who was in Parliament? Who was in Parliament? Parliament was combined, it was controlled by a combination of nobility and merchant classes. For in England, the nobility was not apart from the merchant classes, but had fused with them. Why? Well, that goes back quite far to the War of the Roses, to those wars which came about before the accession of Henry VII, before the Tudors, when most of the old English nobility had been killed off. Most of the English nobility was Tudor nobility, created by the Tudors, new nobility. And that new nobility had never shirked intermarriage or investment in merchant enterprises. But nobility is a term which also needs definition. These weren't big noble families. There were very few of these in England left. They were in the north of England. They were hostile. They were Catholic, by and large. They were, by and large, in the north, in the border region with Scotland. Instead, what we call nobility in England is really much the same as the gentry, the local noble, the local squire. who would dominate elections because he controlled them. There was no secret ballot. He probably had the gift of a seat in the House of Commons in his pocket. The local squire, the local gentry. So that, what was represented in Parliament, was a combination between the local squire, the local gentry, and the merchant classes, whose interest against the monarchy were fused in Puritanism. In Puritanism. We call it now and then the country party as over against the court party. You have something very similar in the French religious wars, where the Catholic League and the Huguenots were also based very largely on a country party against the court party. It's not too dissimilar. But from our point of view, when Parliament said the voice of the people in things of their knowledge is said to be like the voice of God, what they meant actually was that the voice of the gentry and merchant classes in things of their knowledge is like the voice of God. This is important, for it shows you the extent and the broadness of the Puritan leadership. It went down into the localities, into the localities, and eventually you will see among even the common people who were influenced and controlled by the Puritan gentry, wherever the Puritan gentry was dominant, which was above all in Norfolk and the east coast of England, as you will see, but also around London and in the Midlands to a certain extent. Now the man who inherited all of this was James I of Scotland. James I, who in many ways laid the groundwork, but who, as everybody does, came into a position which was made for him. James's options, as we would say, were really rather limited. But his position was increased in difficulty as James really believed in the divine right of kings. And for that he had good reason. He had been a terrifically successful monarch in Scotland. And Scotland was almost ungovernable. Presbyterian Scotland. And his idea of the divine right of kings had grown up because he was tired of having Scots pluck him by the sleeve and say, there is a God above you and we all pray, kingdom come. He was tired of that. He knew what Calvinism meant, and against it he elaborated his idea of the divine right of kings. But when he came to England, he was already, by these times, middle-aged, over middle-aged. He was in his 40s. And he believed coming to England, he was coming to a unified nation without, as he hoped, Presbyterians or Scottish nobility. A nation where he could be a divine right king, where he could be to England what Richelieu made Louis XIII to France. Remember, James I and Richelieu were contemporaries. And so he immediately drew the lines. He immediately, as we would say, forced the issues. Forced the issues, but it is difficult to see, I think, what other options he could have. He forced the issues on two fronts. The Puritan front, whom he hated, of course, having experienced the Presbyterians in Scotland, and on the economic front, where he was in very deep water indeed. When his queen died in 1618, she had to lie for 3 months before she could be buried because the money was not available. Well, with all the smells around, as I told you the other day, that wouldn't have mattered a great deal. Secondly, in economics then, he drew the line. And thirdly, he drew the line in foreign policy. All these became involved in the king against a parliament, strengthened by its past history, strengthened by the Elizabethan compromises. All these lines he drew against the Protestants, for he inherited a Church of England which was still unsettled. His Church of England, which was still, as it were, not settled on any known religious base. It was still neither Calvinist, Zwinglian, or Lutheran. It was, in fact, Anglican, which meant it was so broad as almost to have no theology at all. So that James inherited, as Elizabeth had, an Anglican church that was without, for the Puritans at any rate, a major theological base. A parliament controlled by a revolutionary elite going in for what we would call radical politics. And he inherited, moreover, an economic situation that was going from bad to worse, and a situation in foreign policy where the Armada, glorious as it was, settled nothing, where the Armada had, in fact, settled nothing. So that the reign of James I is the direct antecedent of the English Revolution. And here I will stop, because you have asked me to stop 10 minutes early, and I always do as I'm told, if I think it's right. Anyway, so if you have any questions, this is the time, yes. But you will have to speak up. The acoustics, which are not my fault, are bad. Yes.